All right, good afternoon, everyone. Happy Thursday. Before we get started, we are going to cover some of our housekeeping rules for today. This training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through Kluin for those not able to join us live. The Kluin training page offers the slides for you to download under Download Training Materials as well. Please use the Q&A box to ask questions, make comments, or report any technical problems at any time. We will have two question and answer breaks, one about halfway through the training today, as well as one at the end of the modules. For those of you that are interested in receiving certificates of completion, those will be available upon completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the form and click the box to certify that you participated today, that certificate will be provided to you. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as Kluin. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal governments, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you are participating in today. If you'd like to be a part of ITRC, please visit the ITRC website, where you can register for teams and learn more about how you can be an active ITRC member. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on the ITRC website. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, PFAS Beyond the Basics, Sampling, Analysis, Surface Water and Air Occurrence, which is based upon ITRC PFAS team online resources. My name is Sarah Levy, and I will be your moderator for today. I'm going to turn it over now to Christy Herzer with the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation, which is one of the state team leaders for the ITRC PFAS team. Christy will now introduce us to today's trainers. Welcome, Christy.
Thank you, Sarah. And as Sarah mentioned, this is our very first offering in our new series, PFAS Beyond the Basics. Today we're going to be going more in depth than our introduction to PFAS training. We'll be covering PFAS sampling, including surface water, analytical methods, qualitative techniques, data evaluation, and PFAS occurrence in air. We'll be diving more into the technical details than in our introductory PFAS training. I'm very excited to partner with these additional trainers today to bring you this new PFAS training on sampling and analysis. Liz Denley, Alex McDonald, Jamie Fox, and Chris Savitas. We've all worked together on the ITRC PFAS team for many years, and the different perspectives and expertise that will be shared with you today will help you advance your understanding of PFAS sampling and analysis. So we encourage you to take a look at our consensus-driven free technical resources, which can all be found on our website. You can find our technical and regulatory guidance document. We like to call it TechReg for short. The latest version is from September of 2023. So that's on our website, and the training today is based off of that. We also have 13 fact sheets that were updated to remain current with the TechReg. Then we have a number of technical or external tables and information that you can download and access quickly, such as our soil and regulatory guidance values table, which we update approximately quarterly. As a reminder, today's training is beyond the basics, but if you need a refresher or if a colleague wants to watch our introduction to PFAS training, it is archived on the Kluin website listed here. And finally, on our website, we have a variety of shorter and medium length training modules, including our roundtable sessions. As we've mentioned, this is our first and our new offering of our Beyond the Basics series this year. Today, April 18th, you're attending Sampling and Analysis, Surface Water and Air Occurrence. Next week on April 23rd, we'll be presenting Human Health Effects, ecological toxicity and regulations. And registration will open soon for our May 9th training, which will cover biosolids, leaching, mobility, and aqueous film-forming foams. And then on May 23rd, we will have source identification, site characterization, fate and transport, and then we'll wrap up our series on June 13th with treatment technologies. And just as a reminder, these modules will be recorded and archived on the Kluin website for later viewing. Again, this is a Beyond the Basics training, so we do assume that this is not your very first PFAS training and that you've participated in a previous introductory training. So, just to get you oriented, some learning objectives in this module include key elements that make PFAS sampling different than sampling for other contaminants, best practices for preparing for a PFAS sampling event, best practices for sampling for PFAS in different matrices with a focus on surface water and foam sampling, the current state of PFAS analytical methods for different matrices, such as air, some of the basics of compound-specific PFAS analysis, like quantitation and sample preparation, other analytical techniques that are available for total PFAS, and then we'll end on some information on the occurrence of PFAS in air. And now I'm going to turn it over to Liz Denley, who's going to get you started on sampling.
Thanks, Christy. Okay, so today I'm going to start out by talking about we're going to start out by talking about sampling in section 11, but the entire module will cover various portions. Other portions of Section 11, including analytical methods, a little bit on data evaluation. We're not going to be covering source identification. That's going to be covered in a separate training module coming up. We're going to have a specific focus on surface water today, too, with a case study and also looking at sampling foam as well. Okay, so sampling for PFAS in drinking water, other aqueous matrices, soil, sediment, air, biota, other media is similar to procedures that we use for other chemical compounds, but with some modifications and additional considerations. So there's a lot of published guidance out there covering these specific protocols. Federal agencies, many state agencies, and consulting firms have developed guidelines, checklists, and standard operating procedures for sampling PFAS. And although most state-specific documents provide similar guidance, it's really important to check with your regulatory agency to determine if state-specific sampling guidance exists. So the list that you see here and the corresponding links within the TEC reg document cover a broad and useful range of considerations for sampling for PFAS. So this figure, which is in the TEC reg document, prompts you as to what to think about before the project begins. And ideally, the answers to these questions would be put into a work plan or quality assurance project plan. So you're not expected to take everything on this slide in at this time, but in order to have a successful PFAS sampling event, and in order to generate the most representative data, project planning is key. So therefore, establishing project data quality objectives and communicating them to the field team and the laboratory prior to sample collection and sample analysis is critical to ensuring that the correct methods, the correct PFAS compounds, and adequate sensitivity are reported for your samples. So some example questions include, what reporting limits do I need to achieve for each matrix and each PFAS compound? Which PFAS compounds do I need to analyze for? And how do I want the lab to handle aqueous samples with particulates? And does the lab have the proper certifications? And what PFAS method or methods do I need the lab to use? So planning is key to a successful investigation. So before you can plan and prepare for the sampling event, you first have to consider and understand what the project objectives are. So what is the site history? This may dictate, which PFAS compounds you want to include for analysis. The site history can also indicate whether extremely high concentrations of PFAS may be expected in some areas, like in a fire training area. This information may also be useful when determining the frequency of field quality control samples, like equipment blanks. Also, you want to look at what are your project action levels or regulatory screening criteria. The project action levels also need to be considered when you're determining the cleanliness requirement. And the cleanliness requirement is really the project's definition of PFAS-free when you're evaluating sampling equipment, supplies, and field quality control. So, due to many issues that we're going to talk about, routine sampling and analysis plans used for sampling for other contaminants cannot be used for PFAS sampling, as they do not sufficiently address PFAS-specific concerns. So this makes it very important to develop PFAS-specific project quality assurance project plans, as we've talked about. These plans should include PFAS-specific sampling SOPs, which help to improve sampling consistency and overall data quality. Okay, so like any investigation, communication with the lab is also required from the planning stage through the data reporting stage. However, PFAS projects may require additional communication. So, with respect to PFAS, this communication could include discussing verification requirements for sampling supplies. So, we may need the lab to provide verification that a particular piece of equipment or the water used for decontamination and field blanks is clean. So we would want to do that ahead of the investigation and let the lab know the analyte list and the definition of PFAS-free for the project. Because as I mentioned before, the definition of PFAS-free could be dictated by the project action levels. We also need to discuss with the lab the need for additional bottles for field quality control. So again, like equipment blanks, or field duplicates. What volume of sample the lab requires to achieve the laboratory reporting limits quoted for the project, and any project sample preparation requirements, which may, for example, include specifics on how to deal with aqueous samples with elevated total suspended solids. We may also want the lab to understand ahead of time if samples are suspected to contain high concentrations of PFAS, as this could dictate the appropriate sample preparation technique to be used. And it's really important for the lab to be aware of this so that significant cross-contamination issues are not generated within the lab, which can really cause extensive delays. So, if the lab does not have this knowledge, they'll probably have to pre-screen the samples as well. So, PFAS sampling is different from other sampling events due to an increased potential for contamination of your samples to occur. And what I mean by contamination is the unintentional introduction of PFAS into your sample during sample collection, shipping, or storage. And there's three main reasons for this increased contamination potential. So first is extremely low PFAS screening or regulatory criteria. So we're looking at part per trillion levels for aqueous samples and part per billion levels for soil. And these low criteria results in the concentration, which defines contamination, to be unusually low. Second, PFAS can exist at a sampling location at concentrations orders of magnitude higher than the screening or regulatory limit. And because of this, there's an increased risk that routine decontamination procedures would be inadequate and cause samples to become cross-contaminated. And third, some sampling equipment and materials that we typically use for sampling contain or may contain PFAS. So, as I just said, again, some sampling equipment that we typically use for sampling may contain PFAS, and some of these materials may also sorb PFAS more than others. So, many of those state-specific guidance documents that were shown earlier detail specific materials and products to avoid during sampling, and some of those are also shown here. So, unfortunately, there is little scientifically substantiated information regarding PFAS content of many products or their ability to actually contaminate the samples in the field. So, a good place to start is to review safety data sheets or product specification documents for materials being used in sampling. And a good rule of thumb is to review the safety data sheet for ingredients with fluoro or halo in their name. If PFAS is present, an alternative material should be used. If PFAS is not listed, the material may still contain PFAS as it could have been manufactured by a process using PFAS as a processing aid, or maybe stored in a container containing PFAS, such as a PFAS-coated box or a plastic bag. So the rule of thumb for PFAS sampling is when you're in doubt, check it out. If you're unsure about any products you're using in the sample collection process, or you know it contains PFAS but have to use it, then collect equipment blanks, collect extra quality control samples, or have your lab test the materials prior to the sampling event to vet the potential for any impacts to your sampling event. A tiered approach is recommended for these restrictions, and the first tier includes restrictions on the sampling materials that will come in direct contact with the sample media. The second tier includes restrictions on what materials are allowed on sampling personnel or within the staging area. And the focus on restrictions within the second tier should really consider how likely the potential is for contact with the sample matrix when you are using good sampling practices. It should also consider the practicality of the restriction. So you want to, for example, does it compromise employee safety or increase exposure risk? And maybe it is okay for the employee, to wear sunscreen because it shouldn't come in contact with the matrix if you're sampling properly. So, as part of the sampling event, you're going to need to coordinate closely with your lab on the appropriate type of container, size of container, and number of containers needed per sample. And most of the EPA-defined methods have specifications as to the construction material of the container and the use of any sample preservatives. So, listed here are the types of containers allowed or specified by each of the current published EPA methods, and also one DoD method for aqueous film-forming foam, AFFF. Required volumes are also listed where the method specifies. And for aqueous samples, it's always important to collect two separate containers of each sample so the lab has a backup in case something goes wrong with that original analysis. Some of the supplies needed for your sampling event are going to need to be provided by the lab that will perform the analysis. So these would include sample containers, maybe solvents used in decontamination processes, and water used for blanks in the field, and also water used for that final decontamination rinse of equipment. So as we talked about earlier, it's the lab's responsibility to verify these supplies are PFAS-free prior to shipping these supplies to you in the field. The lab should also provide the project with documentation of this verification. If for some reason site water or water other than that supplied by the lab, maybe bottled water, is used instead of the lab-supplied PFAS-free water in the field for any blanks or any final rinse of equipment, a sample of that water really must be sent to the lab for analysis as well. Okay, so sample container preservation, shipping, storage, and holding time requirements are dependent on the method that's intended to be used. The drinking water method, so EPA methods 537.1 and 533, are the only EPA methods requiring the addition of a chemical preservative at sample collection. So these methods are prescriptive, and that changes to preservation, changes any changes to the sample extraction steps, quality control requirements are prohibited by both methods. And whether or not you use method 537.1 or 533 is going to depend on regulatory requirements. And for the UCMR5 sampling that's currently happening in many states, both of these methods are required. For 8327, SW46 method 8327, a holding time study was not performed in conjunction with the validation of this method. However, this method offers a holding time of 14 days from sample collection to sample extraction and a 30-day holding time from sample extraction to sample analysis as a guideline. And DoD has also validated and published a method, DoD AFFF01, for the determination of PFOA, PFOA and PFOS in AFFF concentrates for demonstration of compliance to the mil spec. And this has a 90-day holding time until extraction. And we included holding times and preservation for EPA method 1633 on its own slide as it's a little bit more involved. So the shipping, storage, and holding time requirements for EPA Method 1633 are based on a published holding time study for PFAS in wastewater and surface water, and the result of a holding time study conducted in conjunction with the single lab validation study of this method. So the recovery of 40 PFAS in samples stored at negative 20 degrees Celsius and 4 degrees Celsius, and extracts stored at 4 degrees Celsius was evaluated at defined intervals over the course of 90 days for different matrices. While the holding time requirements are similar for each matrix, you'll see that they are not identical. So there's been observed losses and/or gains, actually, in the concentrations of some PFAS, most likely caused by transformation of precursors, and that's resulted in shorter holding times for samples and extracts held at 4 degrees as opposed to negative 20 degrees for the aqueous matrices. Due to the observed extreme loss of one PFAS, NFDHA, there's an additional caveat in the method that recommends samples be extracted and analyzed as soon as possible if NFDHA is an important analyte for the project for the soil, sediment, biosolids, or tissue matrices. It's not an issue for the aqueous matrix. Also, for aqueous samples, if perfluorooctane sulfonamide ethanols and perfluorooctane sulfonaminoacetic acids are contaminants of concern, there is a shorter holding time until extraction due to potential transformation of these PFAS. All matrices, there may actually be a potential high bias for ether sulfonates if they're analyzed greater than 28 days after extraction. So again, the holding times are a little bit more complicated with EPA method 1633. Okay, field decontamination. So sampling equipment should be thoroughly decontaminated before mobilizing to the field to each investigation area and between sample locations at each investigation area. So, field sampling equipment, including oil water interface meters, water level indicators, and non-disposable and non-dedicated equipment used at each sample location, requires cleaning between uses. When you're using reusable equipment in the field, a close review of the safety data sheets for the soaps and detergents to be used for field decontamination is important. So any soap or detergent that contains proprietary fluorosurfactants should definitely be avoided, and the recommendation would be to only use soaps that have been previously used or tested. If large equipment is being cleaned, it would likely be too expensive and inconvenient to only use that PFAS-free water. So site water may be used for the bulk of that decontamination and then PFAS-free water for the final rinse. And as we stated already, the project action levels must be considered when you're determining the cleanliness requirements. So that's the project's definition, PFAS-free, for which the sampling equipment, supplies, field quality control will be evaluated against. Okay, so although the sampling procedures for most matrices for PFAS are similar to any other contaminant, there are some specific matrix-specific considerations when sampling for PFAS. So for drinking water, the samples should be collected from a cold tap or spigot located at or near the wellhead or pump house, and before the water supply is introduced into any storage tanks or treatment areas. The water should be allowed to flush for 3 to 5 minutes. The sample should be collected while water is flowing, taking care not to flush out the preservative. Samples do not need to be headspace free, so bottles will be capped and then just agitated to completely dissolve that preservative. For groundwater, so groundwater is typically sampled from a well, and so therefore additional equipment is required. So purging and sampling equipment is constructed, as we know, from a variety of materials. And as a result, there are now more opportunities for contaminating the sample by the sampling equipment, like pumps, balers, O-rings, and gaskets that may be Teflon or another fluoropolymer. The most inert material, like stainless steel, silicone, and high-density polyethylene, should be used whenever possible. Dedicated sampling equipment installed in existing wells prior to a PFAS investigation really should not be used without identifying all materials found within that equipment and reviewing it for PFAS content. Pumps can also be a source of PFAS contamination due to internal components. So low flow groundwater sampling is the preferred method of sampling to keep turbidity down and to obtain the most representative sample. Balers should be used with caution due to the potential for PFAS to accumulate at the air-water interface. And if balers are used, it's very important to make sure that at least one well volume is purged to remove that static surface condition. No purge grab or passive samplers may also be acceptable to use for groundwater, and that is we go into a lot more detail on that in the tech reg. Samples should definitely not be filtered, and we'll discuss that a little bit more coming up. So I'm going to pass on the surface water sampling details for now, as we have a separate module coming up just focused on that. Surface and subsurface soil are actually not shown here because there's really no additional precautions other than just making sure the equipment is PFAS-free. For PFAS sampling of sediment pore water, peristaltic pumps with silicon and high-density polyethylene tubing are typically used, along with push point samplers or drive point piezometers, which are stainless steel. Pore water observation devices can also be used for pore water and consist of slotted PVC pipe and silicon tubing. And the pore water observation devices and drive point piezometers are permanent or dedicated sampling points, typically installed and used for multiple sampling events, whereas the push point samplers are used as a temporary sampling location. Otherwise, the standard procedure for pore water purging and sampling using a peristaltic pump can be followed. For sediment, most core and grab sampling devices are constructed of stainless steel. Some core samplers include a high-density polyethylene sleeve inserted in the core barrel to retain the sample. Additional PPE may also be required for sampling personnel, like waders or personal flotation devices, and you need to ensure that materials that will potentially contact sampling media do not consist of water-resistant coatings or other PFAS-containing materials or substances. For wastewater, because some PFAS are known surfactants, EPA Method 1633 does not recommend composite sampling for compliance monitoring under the Clean Water Act. Therefore, they prefer that these samples are grab samples. And for fish, the species of fish collected, as well as the portion of fish samples, so like whole versus fillet, depends on the project goals. And that's maybe if you're looking at ecological risks or human health. Studies have shown that the majority of the PFAS are stored in the organs, not the flesh. So this would be very important to communicate to the lab prior to field work, because you need to determine the necessary quantity and quality of tissue they need, fish handling requirements, the laboratory sample preparation, including maybe single fish or composite fish samples, and whole or fillet preparation, and also packaging and shipping requirements. So according to EPA Method 1633, whole fish or other biota samples should be wrapped in aluminum foil or a food-grade polyethylene wrapped, and homogenized tissue samples should be placed in high-density polyethylene containers. Okay, so filtering of water samples. So these samples really should not be filtered because filters may be either a source of PFAS contamination or PFAS may be adsorbed to the filter. So we would not know if a reduction of the PFAS concentrations would be because of PFAS sorption to soil or sediment or due to adsorption of PFAS on the filter. So alternatives to field filtering for groundwater could include the use of low flow sampling techniques. But for all water matrices, centrifuging in the lab may also be a possibility. So now I'm going to turn it over to Alex McDonald to discuss some sampling specifics when it comes to PFAS in surface water and foam.
Thank you, Liz. And good afternoon to all you people on the East Coast and people here on the West Coast. Good morning. So what I'm going to be doing is giving you the surface water sampling information. Trying to get this to go down. So this part of the training concerns sampling of surface water. Focus on surface water is due to unique PFAS attributes and the myriad of potential beneficial uses of surface water compared to sampling of other media. We're going to provide information to you to consider in developing your site-specific sampling plan We're not going to provide a prescriptive sampling plan as goals and objectives vary with the project. This portion is divided into three sections: beneficial uses, sampling considerations, and a case study. If investigation involves sampling of surface water, then the assigned beneficial uses of the surface water bodies in question need to be determined. In order to streamline the process, we looked at potential beneficial uses to determine which ones could be impacted by PFAS. We started with the 21 beneficial uses of surface water listed in the Water Quality Control Plan for the California Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board. We then eliminated those that would not be impacted due to PFAS, beneficial uses such as navigation, power generation. We then took the remainder of those and combined those that would have the same result. As an example, warm water habitat and cold water habitat would be the same, basically, looking at maintaining aquatic habitat. What remained were six beneficial uses that, if you protected for those six, all 21 beneficial uses would be protected. Those six are: first one's drinking water source, habitat for aquatic life and wildlife, human consumption of aquatic organisms, human contact with water during recreation, agricultural supply, which includes uses for horticulture, dairy operations, and ranching, and lastly, groundwater recharge. Here we are getting to the first of several slides on sampling considerations for PFAS. First, you need to assess the beneficial uses of the water body. Depending on goals of the sampling and the beneficial uses assigned to the water body being evaluated, that list of six could be further reduced for the project. Example, if the goal is to assess for the beneficial use as a drinking water, then sampling the water column in several places is warranted. However, if you are assessing impacts on biota, then water column and biota samples would be needed. Now, if you look at the pictures on the right-hand side of this slide, potential sources of PFAS to the water body are prime sampling locations. Here we show three significant sources: stormwater runoff, wastewater treatment plant discharges, and runoff from biosolids application areas. However, you must note that sampling wastewater treatment plants has a further complexity in that some of these facilities have a direct pipe discharge, while others use diffusers, which provide more mixing of the effluent with the receiving water. Thus, the location and depths of the samples can be affected. Sampling location within the water body is driven by the sampling objectives and location of sources. It is good to sample upstream and downstream of potential PFAS sources. As you saw in the previous slide, some of the sources would be wastewater treatment plant discharges, stormwater runoff, and biosolids application areas. Groundwater that discharges surface water is another potential source of PFAS. Locating samples upstream and downstream of the discharge of groundwater to surface water and sampling near the sediment surface water interface where the discharge is occurring are things that should be considered. The bottom right figure you see shows a unique attribute of PFAS is both hydrophobic with its tail rising above the water and hydrophilic with its head sitting below water. This causes PFAS to accumulate at the air-water interface with the highest concentrations found there. Thus, neglecting to collect samples at that interface can miss a major portion of the PFAS in the surface water. Another unique thing about PFAS is it can form foam on the surface water, provided there are sufficient concentrations of PFAS and there's turbulence from wind and or waves. We are not talking about AFFF, nor are we talking about foam that is formed by turbulence and dissolved organic carbon in the water. So, looking at the picture on the right here, note when the foam is formed, there are several layers that have different properties and differing concentrations of PFAS. The layers start with foam above the surface water where the highest concentrations of PFAS are found. Below the foam is the surface microlayer where the highest concentration of PFAS in the water column is found. This is followed by the nystagm layer, which is rich in biological activity, and then the rest of the water column down to the sediments. Where you want to sample depends on what your sampling objectives are. Keep in mind that the significant concentration can be found in the foam, even if there are none found in the water column. It can be difficult to sample the surface microlayer. You see, it's only 50 micrometers thick. However, the state of Minnesota has developed a procedure to do so, But it takes around 45 minutes per sample, and this procedure so far has not been officially released. However, collection of foam samples is easier, and sampling guidance is available from the state of Michigan with links provided in our document. State of Minnesota uses this guidance to conduct its foam sampling. Some other consideration for foam. Foam transports via wind and water to new locations, providing a source of PFAS at that new location. PFAS-containing foam can collapse and release the PFAS back into the water column. And also, PFAS in foam can lead to additional human and ecological exposure via contact, another pathway that you need to consider in your sampling plan. Sampling from biota. Now, the issues require this sampling from biota requires significant upfront planning, regardless of the pollutant of concern, not just PFAS. You need to determine the species of concern for both human consumption and for protection of the species. Not all species are gathered for human consumption. Select organisms in the size range gathered for human consumption and preyed on by wildlife. As Liz touched on, you need to determine whether you want to sample the whole fish, like eco risk, or just the fillets, human consumption. However, that last part, need to keep in mind that there may be local populations that customarily consume more than the fillets, and that should be considered when selecting the sample types. Once again, Michigan has stepped forward and they have published fish tissue sampling guidance, and with our document has a link to that. There are additional sources available to help you develop the sampling plan. Here are three examples, and links to these and others are provided in the document. We have a general US EPA guidance on sampling, which is not PFAS specific, water sampling guidance, surface water sampling guidance from Michigan that includes sampling for foam, and then a PFAS specific sampling guidance from the state of New York, which includes not just water, but other media. Now we come to our case study. The location of the study is in the state of Minnesota, east of the city of Minneapolis. There are two components we're going to highlight that highlight aspects from the slides we just went through. The first is on surface water-groundwater interaction, and the second one is in regards to foam. In 2019, Minnesota was developing a project that had transportation and surface water drainage improvement components. In the area of the project, there are two known PFAS contamination source areas, and sampling was requested to determine if there would be impacts on the project's construction and implementation. The two potential source areas of PFAS are the Oakdale disposal site you see on the far right, far left, excuse me, and the Washington County landfill shown in the center that received waste from a nearby PFAS manufacturing facility. Note the surface water flow shown by the magenta arrows along the creeks that's flowing to the southeast and east along those drainage channels, and a number of lakes and ponds connected by these water transport features. Groundwater flow, as shown by the red arrows, is to the west near the landfills, but switches to the east on the east side of Lake Elmo. That's the big blue lake you see in the middle there. And this is due to a groundwater divide running approximately north-south just east of the lake. Initial samples collected from these water bodies found PFAS. So how did the PFAS get into the surface water since the two sources are landfills? Turns out that leakage from the Oakdale disposal site entered groundwater, which surfaced in a wetland to the south. Water from the wetland entered the two creeks you see there and were sent the PFAS eastward, seeping back into the groundwater 1 mile downstream. This underground flow reappeared in the creek a bit farther to the east. The other source, the Washington County landfill, had a groundwater extraction treatment system that was for 7 years discharged this treated groundwater to the drainage system heading south, having removed the pollutants it was designed to treat and leaving in the PFAS. Farther downstream from the drainage system, the drainage system from the landfill entered the PFAS coming from the Oakdale site. As the surface water flowed to the east toward the St. Croix River off the screen to the west, excuse me, to the east, it leaked It leaked to groundwater along the PFAS leaked to groundwater along the path of the creeks and drainage canals, and also from the lakes and ponds. During the collection of surface water samples for PFAS, foam was noted on various surface water features. Sampling of the foam and surface water at co-locations was undertaken during 2019 to 2020, as well as where foam was not found. The sampling locations where foam and the surface water samples were co-located are shown by the stars in the figure. The highest concentrations of PFAS were found in the samples were PFOS and PFOA. Note that the color-coded stars for PFOS and foam range from 1.1 ppb to 30,000 ppb. If you look closely, you'll see Jason. Excuse me. Let me go back here. If you look closely, you'll see numbers adjacent to four sample locations. You see them along Raleigh Creek. During the next slide, we're going to look at the PFOS results of those four locations in a little more detail. This figure shows some of the data that was collected for PFOS. PFOA data looks fairly similar, but at slightly different concentrations. This figure represents PFOS in water concentrations at four representative locations shown on the figure by the orange bars. So the orange bars are the PFOS concentration. And the figure shows up by the stippled bars is the concentration in foam. The PFOS concentration is in the range of 1 ppb in the water samples, and the concentration in the foam ranges from 15 ppb to 30,000 ppb. Ratios of foam concentrations to surface water concentrations of the two provide enrichment factors from 16 all the way to near 10,000. Another thing found in the sampling is that the short chain PFAS were enriched only slightly or not at all, while the longer chain PFAS shows significant enrichment. This shows that forming foam removes, at least temporarily, PFAS from the water column. Remember, in the previous slide, we said that foam can collapse, releasing its PFAS back into the water. This highlights the need to evaluate foam separately and can help make decisions on early remediation efforts, such as removing the foam as soon as possible to eliminate large sources of PFAS from the surface water and reduce potential human and ecological exposure. Let's turn back to groundwater for my last slide. What was all the outcome of that leakage to groundwater? Eight municipal water systems and 2,700 individual wells were impacted by PFAS. This figure shows an expansion of the same area we saw in the earlier figures for the St. Croix River, 8 miles to the east. The blue circles represent wells exceeding the state action level, and those that are green are below the action level. That level is set at 1 and is measured against the ratio of 6 prevalent PFAS for which Minnesota has established individual action levels and their respective action levels. So if you look on the blue box, there's a formula to determine whether that well will be a blue dot or a green dot. So taking the concentration of each of those 6 you see PFAS on the left-hand side of the equation, dividing it by its individual extraction action level, and if that's greater than 1, then the well has a blue dot by it. Note the abundance of blue circles around the drainage courses and ponds. By looking at the frequency of blue dots, you can see the change from westerly to easterly groundwater flow. In summary, this study area shows that PFAS-containing foam does exist and acts in removing PFAS in the water column and presenting itself as another factor to be considered. It also shows that groundwater-surface water interaction can lead to the spread of contamination to unsuspecting areas and far from the source area. If you're looking at potential exposure to PFAS, these attributes need to be considered when setting up your site-specific sampling plan. And with that, I think I'm turning it back over to Liz.
Thanks, Alex. Okay, so now we're going to move on to air sampling. Okay, so currently there are no multi-laboratory validated published sampling methods for PFAS in air emissions. In 21, EPA released other test method, OTM-45, and this is a performance-based method and can be used to measure 50 specific semi-volatile and non-volatile polar PFAS from a variety of stationary sources. So this method is still under evaluation, and it's going to be updated as more data from stakeholders become available. OTM-45 sampling is a complex process for collecting stack emission samples. It covers the different aspects of how PFAS may present itself in that unique sampling situation. So whether PFAS are present as particulate, adsorbable PFAS, or soluble PFAS. The method requires additional field quality control measures, including field blanks and isotopically labeled field spikes that the lab adds to the sampling media prior to use in the field. And the sampling train involves use of materials like XAD that have to be thoroughly cleaned prior to use. Okay, so OTM-45 is largely based on a modified Method 5 sampling train with several modifications. And this is a picture here of the sampling train. So PFAS can be partitioned in stack emissions into several different fractions due to the physical properties of different PFAS compounds. And at the elevated temperatures that are typically encountered in stack emissions, the vapor pressure can be sufficiently high that PFAS are present in the gas phase. The lower molecular weight PFAS, like fluorotelomer alcohols, have lower boiling points, and so may primarily be present as vapors. So PFAS can adsorb to particulate matter, are highly water soluble, and they can dissolve in water droplets if present in the stack. And to measure these partition fractions, the stack effluent is sampled isokinetically. So the air enters the probe at the same velocity as it's moving in the stack to accurately sample particles and droplets. And then it's captured on a heated filter, an XAD sorbent resin tube, and then into water impingers. And then in some programs, the second XAD sorbent cartridge is included in the train to determine if breakthrough has occurred. And then the filter, the sorbent cartridge, and the water impingers are recovered separate methanol ammonium hydroxide solution. Okay, whoops, I want to go back. Okay, so the PFAS are collected in four sample fractions: the filter, the primary XAD, the impingers that contain the water, and the second XAD for breakthrough determination. And each fraction with its associated rinses is extracted and analyzed separately. And then the analyses, which we'll hear a little bit more about later, are performed by isotope dilution, liquid chromatography, dual mass spectrometry. And the analytical approach is based largely on EPA Method 533, includes some of the same analytical qualification criteria with some additional requirements of monitoring confirmatory secondary transition ions, similar to Method 1633. But field sampling programs must include collection of field blanks as a means of assessing PFAS artifacts present in the sampling media and potentially introduced during sample handling in the field. Other quality control measures that I mentioned earlier include the use of isotopically labeled PFAS spikes. So these are field spikes or spiked by the lab into that XAD sorbent media prior to field deployment. And they serve to assess the PFAS collection efficiency, breakthrough, and the accuracy of the combined sample collection and analytical method on a sample-specific basis. So the field spikes are useful for quantifying losses associated with field collection techniques, since the lab, again, is spiking the media used in the field, and then any losses can be measured. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about field quality control. So table 11.1 in the tech reg document includes typical field QC samples like field reagent blanks, source water blanks, field duplicates, or equipment blanks. And this table in the tech reg also provides the frequency, the recommended frequency for these QC samples. And these are for matrices other than air. Also, collection and analysis of field quality control samples are important, right, for PFAS investigations, because we're looking at very low reporting limits and very low regulatory criteria down to parts per trillion to ensure accuracy and representativeness of the results for the sampled media and to assess potential cross-contamination due to the extensive use of PFAS. Ultimately, the quality assurance project plan that you create for your event should fully describe the field quality control needed. If the sampling event involves drinking water methods, then you need to make sure that the additional requirements of the drinking water methods are met, like the frequency of field reagent blanks, the use of field duplicates, and the frequency of matrix spikes. If the drinking water analyses are for samples that could be used or considered for compliance, the omission of some of these additional field QC samples could actually invalidate the sample data that are generated. So, equipment blanks and field blanks are really critical to evaluating the validity of your sample results. Pre-investigation equipment blanks could be collected from non-dedicated equipment or supplies at the start of the sampling event prior to sample collection, just to verify that non-dedicated equipment supplies are that they're PFAS-free. And this again could be things like decon water, methanol, new equipment, plastic bags for sample containers, sunscreen, insect repellents, anything that you're unsure of. Equipment blanks in general are used to assess the adequacy of the decontamination process and or to really to evaluate potential contamination from equipment. Equipment blanks should be collected from non-dedicated sampling equipment at a minimum rate of once per day, either during or at the end of each day following decontamination and prior to its next use for the duration of the sampling event. And equipment blanks are collected by rinsing a piece of field sampling equipment with laboratory verified PFAS-free water and then collecting that rinsed water in a sample container for PFAS analysis. Equipment blanks are not required for EPA methods 537.1 or 533 because drinking water compliance samples are generally collected from the source without the use of other equipment. And collection of an equipment blank from decontaminated soil sampling trowels may only warrant a frequency of once per day, whereas groundwater pumps may warrant an equipment blank prior to the pump being deployed down each well, just due to their more rigorous decontamination procedure and the higher contact time with the groundwater being sampled. Field blanks are used to assess contamination from field conditions. These are also sometimes called field reagent blanks, and they are required for all drinking water programs. Field reagent blanks may also be warranted during collection of sampling media other than finished drinking water. And the recommended frequency outside of EPA method 537 and 533 is one field blank per day per matrix, or one field blank per 20 samples per matrix, whichever is more frequent. And the field reagent blank just consists of a sample bottle. It's filled with PFAS-free reagent water. It's prepared in the lab, sealed, and it's shipped to the site along with the sample bottles. And then also an empty sample bottle containing only preservative is also shipped along with each of those blanks. And the sampler takes, he pours the un, he or she pours the unpreserved PFAS-free reagent water into the bottle with the preservative and sends it back to the lab for analysis. Field reagent blanks also really just help us to determine if PFAS were introduced into the samples during sample collection, handling, and kind of help to account for additional factors like introduction of contaminated airborne particulates. So, some takeaway messages from this module. So, special considerations for PFAS sampling, exist. What matters is really what comes in contact with the sample, and make sure you have an approach to deal with potential contamination concerns. There are specific PFAS sampling protocols that have been recommended and are in the TechReg document. Method-specific requirements for sampling, sample preservation, shipping, and holding times vary, so make sure you check those before you start your events. And like we started with this module, sample event planning, upfront work is key, and communicating with your lab and communicating with your field staff is very important upfront. So this concludes the module on PFAS sampling, and I think we're going to move to Q&A.
All right, thank you so much, Liz. Now at this time, we are going to start our first Q&A session. At any time, all of our attendees are welcome to type any questions you may have into the Q&A pod, which is in the bottom right corner of your screen. And we're going to try to get through as many questions as we can in this first Q&A pod. And then just as a reminder, we will have a second Q&A pod at the end of the training as well. So to start off with our first question, trainers, is using SNAP, no purge, or passive samplers acceptable for PFAS sampling?
Okay, I'll take that one. For groundwater, passive sampling techniques that are either grab samplers like the SNAP sampler or equilibrium-based samplers like passive diffusion bags are acceptable for PFAS sampling. They help to keep the turbidity of samples to a minimum and help keep purge water volume to a minimum. And that sometimes they also result in lower sampling costs. There are certain like hydrogeological conditions that have to exist for passive sampling to be useful. And I encourage you to look at section 11 of the tech regs for more information on that. And also before you use any passive sampling device, it's really important to make sure that the sampler itself has been validated for the PFAS that you're concerned with, and of course, to make sure that it's acceptable by your regulatory agency.
Thank you, Liz. Our next question is, how should composite sampling be conducted for analysis by EPA method 1633?
Okay, I'll take that one too. For composite sampling, I'm assuming the question is focused on wastewater discharge effluent. Because PFAS, some PFAS are known surfactants, the EPA method 1633 does not recommend composite sampling for compliance monitoring. They prefer grab samples. I think I mentioned that. But there are times when composite sampling may be approved by a regulatory agency, and if so, EPA method 1633 does have some rules. So they require that only high density polyethylene tubing be used. If a peristaltic pump is used, a minimum length of compressible silicone rubber tubing can be used in that pump. And before use, each lot of tubing must be thoroughly rinsed with methanol, followed by repeated rinsing with reagent water to minimize any potential sample contamination. And the method also says that a final reagent water rinse should be collected from that tubing and analyzed for PFAS just to confirm that the tubing is suitable for use.
Great, thank you again, Liz. We will move on to our next question, which reads, what is the recommended frequency for collection of field banks?
Okay, I'll take that one. The frequency of field blanks, as we just talked about. So, if it's a finished drinking water sample and you're using EPA method 533 or 537.1, parts 0.1, the requirement is one field reagent blank for every sample set at each site. And a sample set is defined in these methods as samples collected from the same sample site and at the same time. For other matrices, we recommend in the tech reg one field blank per day per matrix per sample set, or one per 20 samples per matrix, again, whichever is more frequent.
Excellent, thank you. Moving on to our next question. For sampling surface water, is it possible to sample the four different layers shown in the graphic and at multiple layers? Or and at multiple levels, excuse me, in the surface water.
Yeah, I'll take that one. Yes, you can easily not you can yeah. There are ways to sample all those different layers if you choose to. You got to keep in mind sampling that surface micro layer and the Knudsen layer are really difficult since they're only up to 50 micrometers in thickness. So it's hard to grab a specific sample out of that location. Sampling of this of the water column at multiple depths is fairly easy and standard to do. US EPA has a guidance on collecting depth-specific samples of a surface water, so you can look at that guidance to find out how to do that.
Great, thank you, Alex. We did have another question, which is asking, is EPA method 1633 finalized or is it still in draft? And do you expect any changes?
I can take that. So EPA method 1633 is finalized. I don't think it has not been published in the Federal Register yet, 40 CFR. And also recently EPA put on their website a list of errata and clarifications after they finalized it in January. They finalized this past January and just recently put a list of some clarifications and a few minor errors that have been caught since it's published. So I encourage you to look there as well.
Great, thank you. Moving on to our next question. For the case study, is the PFAS-containing foam still detected on surface water? Is it intermittent or does it appear in different locations?
Good question. The I'll take it to answer. I'll try to answer that again. PFAS-containing foam is still found across the creeks and primarily during after periods of stormwater runoff. It's found not always in the same locations due to all the conditions that need to be met to actually form foam. You know, you needed a concentration of PFAS, plus you need a sufficient turbulence and or wind action to create that. So after a storm event, it makes a whole lot of sense since you will have a lot more turbulence going on, and you can actually have additional concentrations of PFAS entering the surface water from that stormwater runoff.
Thank you, Alex. And it looks like our next question is somebody from our Q&A pod wrote, I saw aluminum foil mentioned to wrap fish samples. Are there any issues with using aluminum foil?
Right. I know there have been some concerns in the past about using aluminum foil, but I think those concerns have recently gone away. I mean, EPA is now allowing it in Method 1633. I have heard that, you know, when you are using aluminum foil, you should probably make sure the shiny side is away from the sample. And I also just want to point out, if you are concerned about the aluminum foil, you can always do an equipment blank from it just to see if there is any PFAS that might contaminate your sample.
All right, thank you, Liz and Alex, for helping us answer some of those questions. We will have one more opportunity to answer questions at the end of class today, but remember that you can use the Q&A pod at any time during the training. Our trainers are monitoring it during the presentation. So now at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Jamie Fox to introduce analytical methods for us.
All right. Well, thank you, Sarah. Right, there we go. All right, hello everyone. I'm going to be covering the analytical methods portion of this presentation and the training. And so we have some learning objectives here in this module. They include the current state of PFAS analytical methods for different matrices, including air, some of the basics of compound-specific PFAS analysis, like quantitation and sample preparation, and some other analytical techniques that are available for total PFAS. So there are two EPA methods applicable to drinking water sampling and analysis, EPA methods 537.1 and 533. They have different analyte lists. As you can see, 537.1 contains 18 PFAS as in its most recent version, and EPA method 533 with 25 PFAS. Both are required under the current fifth unregulated contaminant monitoring rule, or UCMR 5. These methods have quite a few similarities, including the use of SPE, analysis by LCMS/MS, and limited modifications that can be made by the laboratories. Some of the differences include the preservation, what method of quantitation is used, and different holding times, as was mentioned previously by Liz. Here you can see the target analytes in each method and which overlap in the center. Here there are 14 PFAS common to both methods. In UCMR5, these are all required to be analyzed and reported using EPA 533. There are four on the left that are unique to EPA 537.1. For that reason, UCMR5 requires the use of this method for reporting these PFAS in addition to 533. And as you can see on the right, 11 PFAS are unique to EPA 533. All 25 PFAS encompassed by EPA 533 are required to be sampled, analyzed, and reported using this method. And if you refer to Table 2-5 in the Naming Conventions and Use section of the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance document, you'll find much more information of how these and other PFAS analytes are categorized in family tree hierarchy. The need for PFAS testing of many other common environmental matrices besides drinking water is addressed by EPA Method 1633. First issued as a draft method in the fall of 2021, it is now a multi-laboratory validated method and is a result of the collaborative effort between the DoD and EPA. This method is applicable to 40 PFAS in groundwater, wastewater, surface water, leachate, biosolids, tissues, sediments, and soil. So it covers a wide range of matrices. One thing the drinking water methods and the aqueous section of EPA 1633 have in common is the entire container used to collect the sample must be used for extraction and analysis. Therefore, even if a laboratory requests 500 mils of water per sample to have enough volume for backup, in the case of methods 537.1 or 533, which use 250 mils per analysis, that will necessitate the collection of two 250 mil containers rather than one 500 mil container. Additionally, the container must be rinsed and included as part of the extraction and analysis. EPA Method 8327 was released in 2021 and provides another protocol for PFAS analysis of non-potable water. The intention was to build something that was quicker and simpler than the extraction-based methods and less prone to contamination issues. It does not include an extraction process and instead simply requires adding solvent to the sample and analyzing. The other advantage is that it requires significantly smaller sample volume versus other PFAS methods. However, as we'll discuss in a moment, it is best used for screening purposes. As mentioned earlier, draft OTM 45 involves a detailed and complicated sampling and analysis technique that determines semi and non-volatile polar PFAS in particulate, absorbable, and soluble phases. This method includes the complete sampling, sample preparation, and analytical procedures. Recently released by US EPA, OTM 50 addresses the sampling and analysis of volatile and nonpolar fluorinated compounds from air emissions and stationary sources using passivated stainless steel canisters. This method is intended to monitor for products of incomplete combustion or PICs. These can be created during incineration or other destruction methods of PFAS compounds. The analytical technique differs from other PFAS methods described previously as it utilizes GCMS for detection for up to 30 compounds. During the single laboratory validation, detection limits of less than 1 microgram per cubic meter were observed. Water and CO2 measurements in conjunction with stack or duct volumetric flows are required as part of this method. This method, DoD AFFF01, is applicable to AFFF concentrates for the determination of PFOA and PFOS by LC-MSMS for qualification and compliance to the MIL-SPEC MIL-PRF 24385. Laboratories must be DoD ELAP accredited to perform this method in order for the results to be used for compliance and qualification, and must achieve an LOQ or limit of quantitation of less than 25 part per billion for PFOA and PFOS each. Shown here is a list of other methods available for determination of PFAS in various matrices, including food and human serum. Note the ASTM D8421-22, not shown here, has also been released for non-potable water and, like EPA 8327, is a direct inject method. However, it has an option to use isotope dilution quantitation. The quantitation scheme utilized by each method varies. There are three quantitation schemes possible: external quantitation, internal standard, and isotope dilution quantitation. Depending on the scheme used, bias associated with sample preparation, instrumentation, and matrix interference may or may not be accounted for in the quantitation of individual PFAS. External quantitation does not count for any of these biases. An example of a method which utilizes this quantitation is EPA method 8327. Internal standard quantitation utilizes the recovery of standards that are spiked into sample after sample preparation, but prior to analysis, to adjust for the calculated concentrations of individual PFAS and to account for instrumentation bias. An example of this quantitation is EPA method 537.1. The results from these non-isotope dilution techniques report concentrations of the target compounds and recovery results for surrogates, and it is up to the data user to determine the impact, that is, or the bias of the extraction and analysis on the sample results, because the results are not recovery corrected. Isotope dilution utilizes the recovery of isotopically labeled standards that are chemically similar to method analytes and that are spiked into the sample before sample preparation. These isotopically labeled standards are used to adjust the calculated concentrations of individual PFAS to account for both sample preparation and instrumentation bias. The quantitation scheme used directly impacts the method's ability to accurately quantitate PFAS down to low part per trillion concentration levels, especially in complex media and those containing potential interferences. Example of methods which utilize isotope dilution quantitation are EPA 533 and EPA 1633. So what is isotope dilution and how does it work? It works by spiking a known amount of the isotopically labeled standards, also known as extracted internal standards or labeled surrogates, into the sample prior to processing the sample. This quantitation technique considers sample matrix effects on each individual PFAS quantitation in the most precise manner possible. It involves quantitation of a compound of interest using a labeled isotope of that very compound. A variety of isotopically labeled analogs, for example, carbon-13 or analogs or deuterated analogs of the compounds of interest. These are commercially available and function from a data usability standpoint as both an internal standard used in the calculation of the target compounds and as a surrogate standard, which is used for calculation of recovery of the standard. Ideally, the number of isotopically labeled analogs used in the isotope dilution technique matches the number of targeted compounds. For example, for method 537.1, that uses three surrogates for 18 target compounds, an isotope dilution procedure like in method 533 will attempt to use isotopically labeled analog for every compound being reported. Non-extracted internal standards are also added to the sample as extract immediately preceding analysis. For the isotope dilution methods, quantitation of the target compounds is performed relative to the response of the isotopically labeled analog, which should recover in a manner similar to how the non-labeled compounds recover. Effectively, the sample data are recovery corrected for losses that might have occurred during sample processing. The isotope dilution recovery correction procedure greatly improves the accuracy of the analysis and is considered to be an improvement over other techniques for the analysis of complex samples for analytes requiring high sensitivity. There are some key method consistencies between all of these methods. All utilize liquid chromatography tandem mass spectrometry, or LC-MS/MS, and analytical standards to identify and quantify the individual PFAS. The analyte list for these methods do not yet include neutral or volatile PFAS, such as fluorotilamer alcohols. For all of these methods, the same equipment and supply concerns associated with field sampling apply. The PFAS analytical method landscape is ever-changing, and methods continue to be developed for additional media and analytes. There are some significant ways in which these methods differ as well that need to be considered when selecting a method. First, the scope of these methods greatly vary. The media each method has been validated for varies along with the limits of detection and limit of quantitation that are available in each media. Method analyte lists vary with respect to the individual analytes included as well as the isomeric profiles of the individual analytes that are included in the quantitation. The topic of isomeric profiles will be discussed on an upcoming slide. Other key differences include holding times and sample extraction and cleanup procedures, so it is necessary to reference the method or discuss with the laboratory to appropriately plan for sampling. This table further highlights the differences between these methods. In general, methods which utilize solvent dilution as opposed to SPE or solvent extraction can result in higher reporting limits. And as discussed before, external standard or internal standard quantitation procedures produces data with a higher potential of unknown bias in the presence of interferences instead of isotope dilution or EIS. Regardless of the method used, care must be taken to prevent sample contamination during preparation and extraction because the limits of quantitation and detection are 1,000 times below part per trillion for those of more routine analyses such as VOCs or SVOCs. It was previously mentioned that there are issues with filtering aqueous samples with particulate matter for PFAS analysis. Centrifuging is a preferable alternative. However, inconsistencies have been observed with how laboratories have approached this step in the past. For labs performing centrifugation and subsequent decanting, it should be noted that it is important that the extracted internal standards are always spiked into the aqueous samples prior to centrifugation. Measurement of TSS, or total suspended solids, or also known as turbidity, can assist in how best to handle the samples. US EPA Method 1633 details a procedure for determining the solids content of aqueous samples. This determination is to be performed using the second container that is required for each sample, not the sample container used to prepare the sample for analysis for PFAS, since subsampling is not allowed in the method. The sample preparation procedures for PFAS analysis in US EPA Method 1633 are applicable to aqueous samples containing less than 50 milligrams of solids. The method provides additional steps to take if particulates clog the SPE cartridge during extraction, including the use of additional SPE cartridges. Solids accumulate high concentrations of PFAS, and specifically some of the longer chain PFAS. Care should be taken to resuspend any solids and to rinse bottles so that measured concentrations consider the entire sample. When these solids settle out in the water samples, concentrations can decrease by an order of magnitude or more. When samples contain greater than or equal to 50 milligrams of solid, depending on the laboratory procedure, the resulting concentrations could be different, and the reported PFAS compounds or fingerprint could be different. Ultimately, the data user needs to work with the laboratory to determine the appropriate procedure to be performed, depending on the end use of the data. For example, remedial action, human or ecological risk assessment, permit compliance, etc. The project objectives may also vary depending on whether the sample matrix is wastewater, surface water, stormwater, or groundwater. For these reasons, laboratories should clearly state whether reported concentrations are considered dissolved or water only, or quote-unquote total PFAS measurements, which include the sample particulate. Laboratories that are not including the extraction of the particulates, as in extracting the water only, are providing a dissolved PFAS measurement rather than an overall PFAS measurement of those aqueous samples. Project objectives will determine whether dissolved or total PFAS measurements are appropriate. It should be noted, though, that drinking water should always represent the total measurement of PFAS. Each PFAS analyte has the p potential to be present in environmental samples in both their branched and linear forms due to the use of the electrochemical fluorination, or ECF, process that was used in past manufacturing processes. The most prominent form of a PFAS is the linear form. However, branched isomer components of a PFAS can account for a significant portion of the concentration of a PFAS present. Because of this, if this fraction of a PFAS is not included in quantitation of PFAS, quantitation of individual PFAS could be significantly biased low. In general, all laboratories should be reporting the sum of the linear and branched isomers for which analytical standards currently exist, which are listed here on the right hand of the slide. In the absence of a standard that includes branched isomers, only the peak associated with the linear isomer is integrated. As more analytical standards become available, more PFAS should be reported as linear and branched in the future. Interferences related to the matrix can be caused by the co-extraction of biosalts, for example, TDCA, TCDCA, and TUDCA. These interferences from biosalts can co-elute with PFOS from tissue samples. These biosalts can vary considerably from sample to sample and by species. The use of carbon cleanup steps, such as those required by US EPA Method 1633, help eliminate these interferences in most extracts. However, when excessive amounts are present in the extract, these steps may only reduce the amount of these biosalts. To address the potential interference, US EPA Method 1633 requires that the chromatographic conditions are adjusted such that these biosalts elute at a retention time beyond 1 minute from the retention time window of PFOS. All right, so moving on to a different area, we covered the targeted methods. Now we're going to move into qualitative analysis. Because of the large number of PFAS and their varied structural characteristics, a single targeted method on either LC triple quad MSMS or GC MSMS is unable to quantify all PFAS that may be present in a sample. When the release source is well understood and the types of PFAS present are both known and amenable to regular PFAS analytical methods, a targeted analytical approach may be sufficient to adequately characterize a release. For releases that are not well understood or consist of multiple sources, alternative ways of measuring PFAS in a more comprehensive but less targeted fashion may be desirable. Additionally, PFAS that are in polymeric form, such as those used in coatings for paper and textiles, are not amenable to LC and GC-based separation techniques. They may also not be effectively extracted, even with rigorous methods. So there are several techniques employing indirect measurement that have been developed that can more comprehensively assess the range of PFAS contamination at a site. These qualitative techniques are not yet standardized through a published EPA method and range in commercial availability. To date, these techniques have not undergone multi-lab validation. Data from these qualitative techniques may augment the definitive data from quantitative methods. And so we'll discuss a few of these on these next slides. The total oxidizable precursor, or TOP assay, is a technique developed to estimate oxidizable precursors that can transform to perfluoroalkyl acids, or PFAAs. These are terminal end products that are included in target analyte lists. The TOP assay does this by converting PFAA precursor compounds to PFAAs through an oxidative digestion. The increase in the PFAAs measured after the TOP assay relative to before is an estimate of the total concentration of PFAA precursors present in a sample, because not all PFAS present will be subject to quantitation or oxidation, and some will remain as undetected PFAS. The PFAAs generated have perfluoroalkyl chain lengths equal to or shorter than the perfluoroalkyl chain lengths present in the precursors. A sample is analyzed using conventional LC triple quad to determine the baseline levels of the PFAS present in the sample. A separate aliquot of the sample is then exposed to a highly basic persulfate solution and then placed in a sealed container at an elevated temperature, roughly 85 degrees Celsius, in a water bath or other heating device. And this thermalizes persulfate into a sulfate radical. At elevated pH, the sulfate radical is scavenged by hydroxide and forms a hydroxyl radical, which then converts the free PFA precursor compounds to PFAAs. The predominant products of the precursors are perfluoroxyl carboxylates, whether or not the precursors contain sulfonoamido or telomer functionalities. After sufficient time has elapsed to convert all the persulfate, the samples are removed from the heated environment, cooled to room temp, and neutralized prior to analysis. The increased concentrations of PFAAs generated after the oxidation step provide an estimate of the concentration of oxidizable PFA precursors. One limitation of this assay is the potential for low bias due to incomplete oxidation, as well as a lack of validated procedure for ultra-short chain PFAS. Adsorbable organic fluorine or extractable organic fluorine paired with combustion ion chromatography or CIC are complementary terms for analysis for fluorine content of environmental samples. In AOF, an aqueous sample is passed through a carbon-based sorbent on which the fluorine-containing organics adhere. The carbon sorbent is then combusted at high temperatures that should completely decompose the organics into their elemental constituents. The gaseous stream is passed through deionized water, which is then analyzed for fluorine content as fluoride by ion chromatography. This is the basis for Method 1621, which recently was finalized and published by EPA. One limitation is that organic carbon above 140 ppm may lead to negative interference by inhibiting absorption of organic fluorine substances to the activated carbon. Also, short-chain PFAS do not absorb as well to the carbon as longer-chain PFAS. However, some fluorine-containing pharmaceuticals and other products that contain one or more organofluorine moieties that are not defined as PFAS may absorb, so thereby causing bias to the data. Another technique is particle-induced gamma ray emission spectroscopy, which measures elemental fluorine isolated on a thin surface. Also known as PIGI, this is a non-destructive analytical technique that takes advantage of the unique gamma ray wavelength emission of fluorine when impacted with a proton ion beam. The technique is not compound specific, but is able to assess total fluorine content of a variety of materials isolated on a thin surface. The sample is secured in the instrument and bombarded under a 3.4 mega electron volt beam for approximately 3 minutes. Two gamma ray characteristics of the decay of the fluorine-19 nucleus are measured and the response is integrated. This is a rapid screening technique. However, like AOF, it is not specific to PFAS. The technique has not been standardized and so far is only available through one laboratory. The last technique I'll describe is non-target analysis. Non-target analysis use high-resolution mass spectrometry techniques such as quadruple time-of-flight, MSMS, or QTOF, and contentatively identify PFAS structures through library matching or in-depth data analysis. With this technique, it is possible to identify approximately 2,400 different PFAS through an existing library search or identify new compounds. QTOF can be used to determine both the chemical formula and structure of unknown PFAS in a sample, but analytical standards are required for unequivocal structural identification. With non-target analysis, chromatography is combined with high-resolution mass spec and multiple ionization techniques to determine atomic molecular weight and associated fragments. These results can be compared to databases for tentative identification. Further spectral interpretation may result in structural identification. Although not widely commercially available, recent source research has focused on the use of HRMS for more comprehensive qualitative determination and fingerprinting for source attribution. As extensive data sets are generated using HRMS, informed data filtering approaches are used to filter the data specific to PFAS-related analytes. The data first screened against previously generated suspect screening libraries that contain chromatographic and spectrometric information for PFAS characteristic to sources such as AFFF formulation, industrial process, and or manufactured products. Then other mass spectrometry-specific data analyses are used to attempt source identification based on the presence or relative abundance of PFAS identified against the suspect screening libraries and other available information. All right, and that concludes that. I think I am now handing this over to Christy. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jamie. So there are three questions that are important in evaluating data. One, have the results exceeded a level of concern? Two, did the results make sense? And three, are the data of acceptable quality? To judge whether the results have exceeded a level of concern, the potential bias or uncertainty in the data should be evaluated along with the sensitivity of the results. Now, without the proper review or validation of the data generated by the PFAS methods, the usability of the data cannot be evaluated. US EPA has published guidance for the review and validation of PFAS data for drinking water collected in accordance with EPA method 537.1. EPA has also published a technical bulletin that outlines the general principles of PFAS data review. Department of Defense validation guidance is in process for data generated using EPA method 1633 and table B24. A summary of key points from these data validation guidance documents is available as an external table on the ITRC website. However, there are currently no published EPA review and or validation procedures to evaluate LC-MS/MS data for non-potable water or solid media. Due to the complex nature of LC-MS/MS data, PFAS data cannot be adequately evaluated using existing guidelines created for other technologies, for instance, GC-MS, as it is often attempted. In addition, the individual performing the review and or validation needs to possess a clear understanding of the technology that was used. So the takeaway points for this section is that while there are multiple PFAS analytical methods published or under development, there are significant differences between them. And these differences do need to be understood and evaluated in order to ensure that their use will enable the project's data quality objectives to be met. There are also lesser standardized techniques available that can be used as a qualitative or screening tool. Such techniques can be helpful, especially when determining the total PFAS load on a treatment sorbent, such as granulated activated carbon. The information presented today is an overview of the information that we have in the ITRC PFAS Technical Regulatory Guidance document, as well as the analytical methods table. If you want a more in-depth understanding of PFAS sampling and analysis, please head to the ITRC PFAS webpage for these documents and other helpful PFAS tools. And before I pass it on to Chris, as we know in the world of PFAS, things are evolving and changing quickly, and today's presentation does represent a snapshot in time. Since the publication of our September 2023 tech reg, several analytical methods were finalized, such as US EPA 1633 as well as 1621. And draft OTM 50 was released, which analyzes for 30 volatile PFAS compounds from source emissions. And there are many things to be on the lookout for in the world of PFAS sampling and analysis listed on the right-hand side. I won't list them all. You can see them there. But a couple of examples, EPA top assay methods and non-target analysis method, as well as ASTM's data evaluation guide for PFAS. And with that, Chris, I would love to pass it on to you for PFAS occurrence in air.
Great. Thanks, Christy. And thanks, everyone, for your interest in today's subject matter. So in this final brief module, our objective is to understand the relative concentrations of PFAS in air, including outdoor air, indoor air, settled dust, and precipitation. I'm not seeing the slides change. Are they moving? I'm sorry, I can't see this. The slides are changing for me. I don't know why. Is someone there to?
They're not changing.
I don't know why. Maybe someone needs to advance them for me.
Yeah, Chris, I can take care of the slides for you.
I don't know why that is.
Yeah, no worries. I got you.
So if you could go ahead, please.
We should be looking at the learning objectives for slide 81.
I think we need to go one or two more slides ahead. There we go. Section 6.1 of the PFAS technical and regulatory document provides an overview of the occurrence of PFAS in air and includes figures summarizing the observed concentrations of PFAS reported in the recent literature, which is generally 2017 to 2022, as well as new information to date on the occurrence of PFAS in media such as precipitation that wasn't included in the previous version of the tech reg. Section 17.1 provides data tables used to develop the figures in Section 6 and includes details about the studies, including where they were conducted. And on the slides that follow, we have noted where some of the studies were performed. And I'll note that Sections 6.1 and 17.1 of the guidance document includes compiled occurrence data for other media, such as soil sediment, surface water, groundwater, and biosolids that we will not be discussing today. Next slide, please. As a reminder, the media-specific tables in Section 17 are intended to provide context to the reader and serve as a starting point for further study as new information on PFAS occurrence is constantly being added to the literature. And next slide, please. So let's begin with outdoor air. Figure 6.1a on the right shows the range of observed concentrations of different PFAS in outdoor air. To highlight just a few examples, the typical range for PFOA and PFOS in ambient air is about 1 to 30 picograms per cubic meter, but can be much higher near major industrial sources, with a maximum of about 50 to 200 picograms per cubic meter for PFOA and greater than 2,000 picograms per cubic meter for PFOS. In outdoor air, concentrations of volatile species such as fluorotelomer alcohols can be in the hundreds of picograms per cubic meter. Next slide, please. So next we'll talk about indoor air. Figure 6.1b shows the range of observed concentrations of PFAS in indoor air. And it's important to note that the concentration of many pollutants can be higher indoors than outdoors due to the presence of indoor sources and depending on ventilation conditions in the building. PFOA measured in the particulate, specifically PM2.5 fraction of indoor air, ranged from about 200 to 1900 picograms per cubic meters in kindergartens in Hong Kong. And in Finnish homes, maximum concentrations of PFOA and PFOS were found to be about 100 picograms per cubic meter and 7 picograms per cubic meter, respectively, while fluorotelomer alcohols were observed in the hundreds of thousands of picograms per cubic meter. Next slide. So moving on to settled dust. PFAS have been found in settled dust collected from floors, air conditioning filters, and carpets in schools, childcare facilities, homes, and workplaces. And figure 6.1c displays the range of concentrations of PFAS observed in settled dust. PFOA and PFOS have been found to range from non-detect to about 650 nanograms per gram and 3,000 nanograms per gram, respectively. And fluorotelomer alcohols have been observed in settled dust from non-detect to about 2,500 nanograms per gram. And other PFAS, such as DIPAPs, have been reported in preschools in Sweden from non-detect to greater than 42,000 nanograms per gram. And next slide. And concluding with precipitation, PFAS have also been observed in rainwater, snow, sea ice, and meltwater, as indicated in Figure 6.1d. Concentrations vary over many orders of magnitude, and PFOA and PFOS are typically present at less than 1 nanogram per liter in remote areas, but are found at concentrations greater than 1600 nanograms per liter and 15 nanograms per liter, respectively, in populated regions. Fluorotelomer alcohols and fluorotelomer sulfonic acids have been observed at greater than 100 nanograms per liter, and Gen X has been found in precipitation as high as 5 nanograms per liter. And that's my last slide. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Chris. So just to recap today's Beyond the Basics sampling and analysis module, what we covered, key elements that make PFAS sampling different than sampling for other contaminants, best practices for preparing for a PFAS sampling event, best practices for sampling for PFAS in different matrices with a focus on surface water and foam sampling, the current state of PFAS analytical methods for different matrices, including air, some of the basics of compound-specific PFAS analysis, like quantitation and sample preparation, other analytical techniques available for total PFAS, and we ended on information on the occurrence of PFAS in air. Thank you so much to all of our trainers, and I will now pass it to Sarah, our moderator, for our last Q&A break.
All right. Well, thank you so much to all of our trainers today. As Christy mentioned, we will now move into our second and final question and answer session. At any time, you can type your questions into the Q&A pod, which is in the bottom right corner of your screen. And we're going to try and get through as many questions today as we can. So starting off with our first question, what are the differences between method 533 and method 537.1 quantitation schemes? Would any of our trainers like to answer this one?
Sure. Yes, I can take that one. So the differences between 533 and 537.1, I think we covered that a little bit. But so the 533 uses isotope dilution quantitation, whereas 537.1 uses the internal standard quantitation. So so I know in EPA method 533, there's a little bit of additional information about how it might be used for some other type of water sources that could be used as drinking water, not just finished drinking water. And I think part of the reason the method addresses that, or method 533 addresses that, is because it does utilize that isotope dilution quantitation. So,
great. Thank you, Jamie. Our next question asks, how should I test for PFAS in stormwater runoff?
I can take that one as well. Liz might have some additional information as well on the sampling side of that question. But in terms of the analytical method used, 1633 would be the method of choice for stormwater sampling. Obviously, the concern around stormwater is the collection of particulate that comes with stormwater. And method 1633 has some limitations around how it handles particulate, so it's good to try to work with the lab when you're sending in those stormwater samples and how you're going to address that particulate. And you know that, you know, there was a couple of slides in there on, you know, really discussing the importance of communicating with the lab on how they best handle particulate. So so I think that's a definitely important piece for stormwater testing.
All right, excellent. Thank you again. Our another question we have asks, are there any laboratories that offer branched isomer quantification, which includes branched isomers in the calibration?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. That you know, what is typically done is, you know, there was sort of a list of different compounds for which branch linear standards exist, and so those should be used as part of the calibration For those compounds. So the any branched peaks that are present in the sample are being included in the measurement for that analyte, not just the linear form. There is the possibility of reporting those separately. I think that might be where the question is headed. You know, can you get separate results for linear versus branched? That isn't part of the method necessarily, but certainly possible. Just for those compounds, yes.
All right, thank you, Jamie, again.
Sure.
We might have some more questions for you, so stay tuned. The next question asks, when comparing EPA method 1633 and 537.1, why is TRISMA not used in 1633? For example, in the case that the aqueous source has potential free chlorine, such as site water used to clean equipment being used to collect samples for analysis by 1633.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question. You know, 1633 for non-potable water does not include any sort of chemical preservative like TRISMA or ammonium acetate like what you see in the drinking water methods. Because those additives or those preservatives are intended to bind up free chlorine, which you would not expect in non-potable water. And so the reason why, you know, you wouldn't do it for, say, a water that was being used for decontamination is that you really, that's a QC sample and you want QC to match what you're doing with the actual field samples. So you don't want to handle those differently by adding preservative to one and not to the other. So I think that would be the real reason why you would want to treat those the same.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Next up, another question we have is, what is a precursor compound?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So definition of precursor, when we talk about PFAS, might be a little bit different than, you know, anybody who's dealt with chemistry and synthetic precursors in order to generate, you know, new chemicals. When we talk about precursors, we're talking about from an environmental perspective, you know, all the thousands of PFAS that exist out there, you know, we're only quantifying a handful of them. And so there is a real concern around all the other PFAS that could degrade in the environment or biotransform into the PFAS that we are concerned about. And so a precursor in that sense is a PFAS that has the potential to degrade and down into a perfluoroalkyl acid that we're targeting. And so so when we're talking about that's what we're really referring to.
Great. Thank you so much for providing that clarification. Moving on, our next question asks, can you explain the difference between OTM-45 and OTM-50?
Sure. Yeah, they are both air methods intended for emissions in stationary sources, but they have a different purpose, but they complement each other in a sense. OTM-45 is intended to measure those semi-volatile and non-volatile polar PFAS, ones that are often of particular concern, and they encompass a lot of the PFAS we tend to talk about, PFOA and PFOS and others. The intention behind OTM-50, which was released more recently, is to look at those products of incomplete combustion so that when you are utilizing some sort of destruction technology, particularly incineration, how might you measure that you're completely mineralizing that PFAS into something that's not hazardous, that you're not forming something else that we then have to worry about down the line? And so OTM-50 is intended for that purpose, is to measure for those products of incomplete combustion.
All right. Thank you again. Our next question is, does isotope dilution method require calibration curve of different isotope ratios?
Can you read the question again, Sarah?
Yeah, of course. Does isotope dilution method require calibration curve of different isotope ratios?
So there are different isotope ratios based on the PFAS that are present. So so when you look at the ion transitions for the primary for the quantitation and the ion transition for confirmation, the abundance of those different, or the responses of those different ion transitions is going to be different depending on the PFAS. So, so you do look at the measured ratio, from each of those PFAS, and that's what you're comparing back to, when you are measuring, that QC parameter in your sample for, whether you're meeting the ion ratio requirement that's in the method.
Excellent. Thank you.
Sure.
Moving on, let's see. What are some of the major sources that release PFAS into the air?
Yeah, I can take that. Major sources of PFAS in air are stack emissions from primary manufacturing facilities. That is, you know, those facilities that where PFAS-containing materials are made into products or chemical feedstocks, or where PFAS are used in fluoropolymer production. But you can also have emissions from secondary manufacturing facilities that use fluoropolymers and PFAS-containing materials, you know, such as those that use products like applied surface coatings on textiles, for example. And section, I think, 2.6 of the tech reg has a lot more on sources of PFAS in the environment.
Great. Thank you, Chris. Another question we have is, how far can PFAS travel from its source?
Yeah, there are sections in the tech reg also. Section 5 gets into PFAS fate and transport. And we're generally talking about both short-term and long-term atmospheric transportation processes. So short-range atmospheric transport and deposition can result in contamination near points of major PFAS emissions, where it can impact soil, groundwater, and other environmental media. But there have been modeling studies, though, that have shown that air emissions from a fluorotelomer manufacturing facility, where they just estimate that just 5% by mass of total PFAS emissions and 2.5% by mass of Gen X emissions are deposited within 150 kilometers of the source. So despite the impact they can have close by that source, most of the air emissions are actually going, traveling well beyond 150 kilometers, where PFAS can really impact and has been shown to impact entire airsheds. And when you get into, think about long-term atmospheric transport, you have those are responsible really for the global distribution of PFAS. You have PFAS precursor, PFAS precursors like fluorotelomer alcohols can travel widely across the earth, deposit and degrade into terminal PFAS or PFCAs, PFSAs. And this is really evidenced by their occurrence in biota as in ice and snow cores as far as the Arctic and Antarctic. PFAS can also be distributed by oceans, where they can actually be deposited as sea spray also onto the land.
Great, thank you, Chris. And it looks like we do have time for maybe one or two more questions. What do we know about emissions from waste treatment facilities that may be handling PFAS waste?
Yeah, we definitely would like to know more. There have really been few comprehensive characterization or full-scale demonstration studies really to evaluate the performance of facilities treating PFAS, you know, things like incinerators, cement kilns, or granular activated carbon reactivation facilities. But there have been a few studies. One study, researchers reported 4/9 destruction removal efficiency, or 99.99% DRE of PFAS through both the at a GAC reactivation facility through both the furnace and the air pollution control systems.
All right, great. Thank you so much for that, for all those answers, Chris. With that, I want to thank all of our expert trainers again for being here today and for their contribution to the ITRC document. We would love to hear back from you today, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that I'm about to put into the chat pod for immediate access. Filling out this feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion by email, and I will be dropping that into the chat right now. If you need further clarification on answers or you would like to ask more questions, please feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. With that, we thank you again for being here today, and we hope you have a great rest of your day.